Hello and welcome to Carter and Moore, Off Script and Onside, a podcast in which we explore the stories, the passion and the progress that's driving women in sport.
Well, I'm Brian Moore. I used to play rugby for England and the British Lions. I'm now co-commentating on what we're going to be discussing today, which is the Women's Rugby World Cup, which is now in its knockout stages.
Well, and I'm Jim Carter. I'm an actor and a sports fan, and I am delighted to introduce today's guest, a Welsh rugby international, a Labour MP for Gower. Please welcome Tonya Antoniazzi.
Hello, how are you?
Very well indeed. Delighted to see you here.
It's great to be here with you two, I can tell you.
We'll see, Tonya.
Now, you're sat in the middle. You're not usually sat there in your position, are you? You're out of position.
I am out of position. Do you want to change?
Oh, no, you know, be better if you're there, because rose between two decided thorns. But you
absolutely
were a prop, so you'd be...
Yeah.
Which side would you have been?
Tight end.
So you'd have been here.
Yeah, I'd be sitting where you are, and you would be sitting here.
Exactly, with my arms around you.
Yeah. Lucky man.
And as an ex-number eight, I'd be nowhere in the picture. Tonya, we just briefly alluded to the fact that you're a rugby international. You played for Wales in the 1998 Rugby World Cup.
I did, yes, many moons ago. That's why this Rugby World Cup being in England is absolutely just fantastic. It's great to see the girls, you know, the women playing sport and from all around the world, just to see the rugby being played and the fun that's being had and the crowds is just electric. And it was good fun back in 1998, but it has changed a lot.
So did you get into rugby as a kid? I mean, well, in Wales, was it in your DNA?
Yeah, I grew up overlooking Stradley Park. Dad played rugby. He was a captain of Kidwelly. My older brother played rugby for Wales under 18s and the 21s, played a couple of times for the Scarlets. And, you know, growing up overlooking Stradley Park, you could smell it. It was exciting, you know, the noise, everything. But there wasn't the opportunity. I didn't have the opportunity until I went to university. There wasn't a university team in Exeter at the time, in 91. So played for the town team. And that's where I got my boots on.
You got your boots on. And within minutes, it seems that you were playing for Wales. It was quite a rise there.
It was. Yeah. Thanks for playing over in Italy, because I got to play over for Benetton Treviso's women team, the Red Panthers. And that really did set me up for, you know, really playing at a high level and having that just an interaction.
Well, that's interesting to me because, you know, Italy latterly came into the Six Nations relatively in terms of the men's tournament. Right back then, there was still that. It surprises me a little bit that the setup was enlightened enough or advanced enough to have, you know, women's teams at the same time, because a lot of that wasn't the case for a lot of men's teams over in Great Britain and Ireland.
Yeah, it's true. I was very surprised to find that setup over there. It wasn't anything I knew about, but because they had the sponsorship of Benetton, and also they had the kind of in the men's team at the time, they had Michael Liner there, and you know, they had other international players there. I think Wayne Smith was a coach in at the time. So you had some big names and lots of investment, lots of interest there, and they were very supportive of the women's team, who had actually that year won the 10th championship in a row and had a great, you know, established reputation. And so, that was 93, so it was really great.
So when you say you were sponsored by Benetton, does that mean you wore all those sort of pink cashmere sweaters? You must have had some fantastic kit,
I had some fantastic kit, yeah. I mean, I looked like a pacer coming back, but it's a great kit. And they really knew how to look after us. You know, we did the boots and on the kit. And everybody was very impressed when I came back and played at uni.
That seemed very, really advanced for the time.
I think it was.
So this World Cup, Brian, you said we're in the
middle of it. I've been commentating for the BBC. I tell you what I think is particularly good about this World Cup. All the games, there have been mismatches. There are mismatches in lots of sports, by the way. It's not just rugby. And given the differential funding and the strides that are being made, that's understandable. The tournament organisers obviously want to get rid of that, and it will get better in later tournaments. But I think we can genuinely say that the rugby action has been worth watching of itself. Not just for people who want to show that they are fans of or allies of. You know, people who are genuinely like sport have been coming along to the games, have been watching on TV and saying, actually, this is worth watching in itself. And I know, I mean, it was a strange thing, just completely anecdotal. I had a grocery delivery for one of the grocery companies, and the driver, middle-aged driver, said, he recognised who I was. He said, you know, how do you think England are going to get on? And then he said, I'm not really a rugby fan. I watch football. He said, but, and then he said, that Eric Hildon and Jess Breach, so he named two of England's star players. So it does prove that people who are not traditional fans are watching, to the extent that they are absorbing the information about individual players, which you would never have thought. And I'm sure the tournament organisers, although this is an anecdote, will be very pleased with that. Because it shows that it is reaching what they wanted to reach.
Tanya, I mean, Wales aren't doing so well, haven't done so well in this. Are you enjoying the Rugby World Cup?
Oh, look, I love rugby, I love sport, but I just want to, you know, I know how difficult it is, and I'm just so proud to see the girls run out there and see the support that they've had. And the Welsh team, they have come on, and they just, as individuals, I bloody love them all. I absolutely love them. They're just great. And they really put their heart and soul into it. Disappointing results. They haven't got through the group stages, but they're well loved, and everybody appreciates the journey that they've been on.
And aren't you responsible for the development of one of the players? Did I hear?
Bless her. Yeah, I just, you know, Alex Callender is an ex-pupil. I used to be a teacher at Bryngwyn School. And I'll just never forget her coming in year seven into the French class and saying, my mum said you played rugby for Wales. And I was like, yeah, I did. I kind of thought, okay. And she was just fabulous. And to see her now co-captain Wales, to see and to watch her journey, I'm very proud of her. I didn't have anything to do with her talent or coaching. That's all down to her, but she is a great woman.
You inspired her, and that's the main thing. I mean, we've just finished the group stages of the World Cup. Highlights for me, thinking, I mean, the odd little corners of it. One was, this might not have been totally seen on screen, was Brian Moore having the courage to take on Amy Cocaine.
I think what it's shown is the seeding system, you know, is genuine. The top teams are coming out, and it was always going to be like that. I think from an England point of view, they did get tested against Australia. My one worry with England is that if they don't get more of a test for longer, you get into a final, and then you get put back for 20 minutes, something happens, you get a yellow card, something goes wrong, the bounce of the ball, and that can be difficult to recover from. And when you've got a team like New Zealand or potentially Canada on the other side who can put points on the board, you can soon find yourself out of the game. And if it's a final, there's no second chances, so you've got that. The rest of it is shaping up well. I think the semi-finals are looking to go to plan, and there are significantly good performances for long enough periods of time to suggest that those will be very good battles indeed.
Yeah. I would agree with that, but I'd also, excuse me, say that, I mean, one of my highlights, you talked earlier about mismatches, was when Samoa kicked a penalty, got 3 points, and the camera went to the crowd. The Samoans were, excuse me, frog in my throat. The Samoans were celebrating like it was a huge victory.
Well, when you're talking about the reality is that they're picking from 200 players.
Who've crowdfunded to get here.
Yeah. Now, that has to change. The investment has to go in. Yeah. And we'll probably get on to the fact that we should get on to the fact, the actual facts about women's sport and what it does or doesn't earn from sponsors and broadcasters, because that's an important point. But it's just the important point of getting them there so it can develop. Because,
of course,
come back to this point, you know, you've got to be able to see it to want to be it. And I know it's a terrible cliche, but it is true.
Yeah, I've just absolutely loved all of it. But for me, just seeing my team run out and just to see the fans there and see all the action on the pitch, it's been absolutely brilliant. And I think we've got to capitalise on this now. Also to see what you're talking about, the sponsorship. You know, we didn't have all of our kit back in 1998. To know that girls are having to crowdfund to get to a World Cup is absolutely, you know, it's just not right. But the sponsorship now that we're seeing coming coming into the game, people, everybody wanting to watch it. Brian, I just think we are moving on. And there is a great future for women's rugby.
Yeah, we are moving on. Women's rugby, women's sport. The problem that you've got is that a lot of sponsors, they always say this, oh, we want to be invested, we understand the power of this, we understand that. When it comes to actually writing checks,
okay.
They don't do it.
Okay. Yeah.
The Deloitte's information that women's global sport is worth $2.8 billion is a bit misleading, because that includes North America and particularly USA basketball, which is a huge driver. And in this country, the Lionesses, rightly because they're very successful as a brand, you know, take a lot of what people think is available to sport in general. So the grassroots sport and non-football sports are still very poorly funded. And, you know, if sponsors want to have a product, this is the time when they need to put the money in to get the returns later.
And this is the opportunity. Sorry.
There couldn't be a better showcase than what we're seeing at the moment. Exactly. With grounds full. I mean, more people watching England in the opening game than watched the final, the World Cup final 3 years ago. 30,000 people at each game in Brighton at the weekend. Yep. That's selling. And when you pan to the crowd, seeing that demographic, which is completely much more mixed than the men's
completely.
Room, families, but, you know, I mean, and men of my age love women's rugby because it seems to be fast, it seems to be dynamic, it might be not as fast as men's
there are
rugby,
fewer stoppages,
so there's more flow to it, hence more excitement, I think, and that sells itself.
Well, I've noticed this even in the commentary box, and to notice it from a commentary box, it has to be quite major, because you're concentrating obviously what's on the field. There is a joy in the crowd, there's a sense of celebration of people going there knowing they're going to have a good time, engaged in the sport on there, but actually knowing in the ground. The grounds, this is another thing, the grounds don't get full at the last second like they do with a lot of men's sports, where they all just all crowd in. They're starting to get full, you know, an hour before, because they know they can sit there, you know, have a good time, talk to people around them. They're interacting with the entertainment that's in the grounds as well. And it's a whole family atmosphere.
Do you see that?
Yeah, and it's just the dynamic. It's completely different from going to a men's rugby game. And it's just the joy to see the young children, you know, your brothers, your sisters, your aunties, your uncles, everybody coming together and just having a ball and having a great time and enjoying the rugby and celebrating it.
So how does that contrast with, you know, you played in a Rugby World Cup 1998, which was in Amsterdam, I think, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
I mean the Dutch and rugby, I don't get that.
Can you remember it?
Yeah. Yeah, I can, yes, oh, Brian. Surprisingly.
You obviously weren't going out in Amsterdam enough then.
Now, what was a particular highlight of that, taking on Kazakhstan, my research tells me?
Oh, I mean, that was absolutely hilarious. Yeah, because Kazakhstan, and they were good because they were fit and they were really, really just dead hard, you know. That's because they were all...
Military.
They were all military. Military, yeah. They were a military side that had come along. In fact, it was quite scary, really.
Did you win?
Do you know, I can't. I'm actually not sure. And I think we did, but it was very, very close.
It might have been like
a 5-0 or a 10-0.
Tonya Antoniadze did beat the Kazakhstan army practically on her own.
I wish.
So, you know, we've said, you know, this World Cup, I mean, the outreach live is fantastic. So as a parent watching it, you know, encouraging your daughter into rugby, would you be afraid of all some of these collisions? Or how does a kid get into rugby now? Is it as physical as it looks on the professional level?
I mean, we were talking about this earlier, weren't we, Brian? And, you know, it's about involving young girls as soon as they can, you know, when they're playing touch rugby, and getting them out on the pitch. It's about ball skills. It's about enjoying being in a team.
What is touch rugby, Tonya?
Well, it's non-contact.
Right, yeah.
Well, the way it goes, because there aren't the numbers. If there were the numbers, you might have a case for separating girls from boys, but there aren't the numbers. So on the Sunday mornings, up until the age of 11, it's mixed, non-contact, so it's tag rugby, which is just like touch rugby, and you have little tags you pull off. They start to introduce contact and tackling at the age of 8, because it's better for children to learn skills when they're not dynamic, they're not big, and the physical differences are not large. And this is one of the things you just have to say to, because I've got four girls, I'd never put any pressure on any of my girls to play rugby because of what I did. They all said they wanted to play. They all enjoyed it. But what you see down there is nothing like. It's just like, you know when you play tag in the playground. That's what it's like, but with a ball. And the impacts are very, very slight. The problem rugby has got is persuading people to go down and try it, because when they see it, they think, oh, that's not at all what I thought it might be like.
Yeah.
You know, big people are not smashing into other big people. This is a very elite level at which, you know, at which strength and power are major factors. The rest of rugby, and the other aspect as well is, for me, is where do you go with a daughter or even a son who is not particularly dexterous? He's not a great batter, you know, he's not particularly coordinated, but just happens to be very brave and very strong. He's not particularly quick, and rugby has a place for that. I'm not...
brave and strong.
I just think, you know, we are in sport now, you know, in rugby, where you've brought up a kind of like an old... don't take this the wrong way, kind of like maybe old-fashioned kind of like perspective that, oh, I don't want my daughter to get hurt or that kind of, that, you know, like, which is what I had. But I was, you know, quite a chunky piece when I was playing rugby. My brother said, go find a sport, you know, where you could throw your weight around. And I did. I found my place. But I love participating, playing netball, playing tennis, very competitive, not as competitive as Brian, mind. But, you know, we're in a place, there is a place in rugby for everybody, whatever shape or size you are, from whatever age. And it's important that we continue to play rugby. I still put my boots on now. Commons and Lords rugby team. You know, we put a women's side together to kind of run out on Twickenham with the greats like, you know, Jill Burns. And it's brilliant that we can still be in our 50s and early 60s playing the sport that we love. And, you know, there is a lot of talk around, you know, the issues around concussion and things like that. But there are things coming on board now. You know, you've got your gum shields, you've got kind of like training. Knowing how to fall is very important. That's what you learn when you're small.
When you're making decisions as a parent as to what to do, you don't just say, if you're sensible, you don't just say, what are the risks? Because they're this, that, the other. And by the way, if you actually contextualise rugby's risks against sports like eventing, you know, where you're falling from horses. I'm not trying to decry other sports.
No.
But there are other sports that do have risks. As a parent, what you should do, if you're honest, is say, look, these are the risks, but what are the benefits?
Yeah.
Now, if the benefits don't outweigh the risks, obviously you don't do it. But there are huge benefits of social inclusion, of body image, of, you know, leadership, of team sports, following people. And for me, rugby's always been a game... certainly at junior level, of friendships, 30, 40, 50-year friendships from the same clubs, people whose weddings, whose holidays, you know, it has that atmosphere, and local clubs do offer that.
And are you still friends with your rugby playing, from your rugby play, the early rugby
playing days? Yeah, absolutely. I still am, and it's fantastic. You know, I've got the likes of Bess Evans, who I played my very first, you know, first rugby game against when she played for Cardiff and I was at Exeter. Still, you know, friendly with the girls I played with at Waterloo, like Jill, and one of, you know, and also many of these are still involved in sport, and therefore it's, you know, with my job as a parliamentarian and with my, you know, keenness to promote women in sport, I still move in those circles, and thanks to social media as well.
What do you reckon it taught you?
So much, honestly. Resilience is one of them. Being able to pick yourself up from the bottom of a scrum that's collapsed, being able to kind of like put your shoulders back and keep going, is something I apply to everyday life. You know, I'm in the tough and the thick of it in my
job. I imagine in Parliament you have to pick yourself up again.
Resilience, as I said. And resilience, particularly now, I think, for all of us, you know, I mean, sort of for kids post-COVID and everything, a lot of kids got sort of pushed back a little bit, and resilience and being able to cope with everything that life throws at you is a major lesson.
It really is, and being part of a team, having the support of your friends there, and having to learn to do things that you may not like doing, but actually, as a team, you have to do that to get to be a winner and to be to feel that joy. It's an absolute joy. Yeah. I think it's an adrenaline thing. It's a participation thing, and that's what I've learned. It's a big kind of like boost to your mental health and resilience.
And do you think sport, I mean, it doesn't have to be rugby, any kind of sport should be part of everybody's life.
Oh, 100%. I think you've got to be as active as you can for as long as you can, because that helps with, you know, your bone density. I sound like a doctor now, I am not. But it is really important.
I would like to point out at this stage that we are recording this on the day there's a tube strike, and I cycled here.
Oh, well,
and I walked here.
Brian walked here, and Tonya came in by helicopter, which landed on the roof from the Houses of Parliament. Two of those
That's
factors
not
true. Are
true,
yes.
With D Ream playing, things can only get better in the background. I was there in 97, then they came in.
Yeah. So, I mean, Brian, you jumped over the fact I said that you had a battle with Amy Cocaine earlier this year. This was in the commentary when, I think this was England Samoa at Franklin's Garden, I think, and Amy Cocaine, the England hooker, decided that she was going to smash a heavy drum right behind you when you
were on commentary. Yes, she did, and it actually shocked me, because I, first of all, you know, I mean, look, this is a generation thing. I don't mind. I don't mind it.
Come on,
you know,
Brian.
At football, I can't be the only one who hates the band who just play The Great Escape all game, and the drummer who you want to just say, can you stop this? Because actually, I didn't pay either to watch in the ground or here to listen to you. I'm quite happy to watch the game without your involvement. You know, I'll pay you. Fuck off.
Keep going, Brian. Come on.
But she badly stuff. And the thing is, the reserve players were sat just the opposite, and they're not newly near the commentary position. And it actually quite shocked me. And I thought, who is doing this? And I thought, it's going to be done. I looked across there. Oh God, no! It's an England player. What am I going to say now?
And the fellow hooker.
Hooker. Can I say politely? Do you mind? Because I'm actually trying to. You got to. And then I think someone nudged me. I said, it's a bit louder than you thought that. We didn't come to blows.
So when you do your commentary, you're sitting in amongst the crowd. You're not in a glass booth or anything.
You're not in the you're not with the crowd in the set, because there's a commentary area, but you're surrounded. You know, there's crowds immediately behind you, and you know, doing whatever they are, and both sides of you. I mean, it is always an interesting thing, because you're obviously concentrating on the game. It is quite, and you'll understand this, it's quite a difficult skill to listen to three people, because you're listening to the ref, you're listening to the producer saying about camera angles, you're listening to your fellow commentators, you're watching the game, and you've got to think and then talk whilst they're still talking as well. And that's a difficult skill.
And this is the point where Brian Moore puts in for a pay rise, because he tells us all about the skills. I mean, we're all out in sympathy with him here, because it's unbelievable. What
he's
he
a bit
does.
Of a windy, isn't he?
The point I was long, very long-windedly in an articulate trying to get to was this: is for me to notice the difference in a crowd means that the difference is quite marked, and I have noticed that the dynamics in the crowd during games, they're very engaged. But it is very much, it's a much more levitous, joyful atmosphere. I think to a certain extent, you know, the men's game is getting a bit cynical now. But the people who go along there are determined to go along enjoy themselves. And they're watching and they're engaged. And the good thing is they're doing both that and they're engaged in good sport as well.
And that's it, Tonya's point. It's for the joy of sport, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the joy that, as a spectator and a player, that you get from sport. And in a way, the mismatches don't matter, because sport is being played joyfully. That's what I'm getting from this.
And we have seen a lot of high-scoring games, you know, obviously. And I think that shows that it's still an entertaining game. You've mentioned the Samoans, you know. You know, there's a lot to get out of playing at the such a high level.
I think the, just a final thing, I think when you're talking about a family atmosphere, you know, people talk about encouraging families. You've seen all sorts of ages being perfectly, you know, happy and safe and being able to come along. You know, you go to some sporting events, and I'm not just talking about football, I'm talking, you know, Olympic events, where it is, you know, it is difficult to create that atmosphere, because the security, you know, the length of queues and all these sort of things. These games are taking place very efficiently. I'm very impressed by the grounds that they've been played in, the staff and what have you. as I say, if it's coming through to me when I'm concentrating on commentating, it's definitely there for everyone else.
And when you, I mean, you, presumably you have to walk to the ground, sort of thing, because you can't get back. I mean, do you feel that atmosphere in the air on the way?
Yeah,
in,
you do. I mean, you see people, you know, and this is, you know, I don't know if this is a generational thing. You know, I wouldn't necessarily walk to a game with a cowboy hat on.
But, you should, though. Yeah, you've got to do it.
That's today's challenge.
Well, not a pink one, anyway. But you know, people are dressing up in the way that, you know, in the way that they do, you know, they do that for the 100, don't they? They do that for you know, because it's a different demographic and they want a different experience.
Brilliant. I detect also, Brian, since the beginning of the tournament, that there's been a slight shift in the commentary that, tell me if I'm pronouncing this incorrectly, Sarah Orchard is starting to explain a little bit more about what a hooker does and people's function within the game, which I think is very helpful for first-time viewers.
Yeah, well, look, it is interesting because people, you know, there are three generations of commentator, you know, just gone. The 20 years, which is a 2003, and then the year, the one before that. Mm. And I'm writing the final, you know, the Triassic or whatever it is, period. But the thing is, what I used to call a drift defence is now called a slide, and what is called a rush defence. So terminology changes, but the basics don't change. Yeah. And what is important is if we are trying to explain things, to people who don't know and need to know, then I will take that every time over boring someone who knows a lot about rugby.
I mean, I've noticed it a lot, and I welcome it, you know, to know that a hooker is in the middle of it, you know, because it could be misinterpreted, couldn't it?
You know, who do you watch with?
I watch on my own.
All right, yeah.
And then when it gets to the critical points, Imelda, my wife, watches it with me, but she gets so excited she can't sit down. You know, I said, just sit down. No, it's too exciting. you haven't, Tonya, you haven't been to any of the games. Have you been able to watch them on TV?
Yes.
Are you too busy fighting the good fight?
Well, yeah, I've been very busy, but you know, I've got my kind of very close knit group of rugby friends, and we have our fantasy rugby team. So I'm very competitive on there.
Who's in there? Can you remember?
Well, Alex Callender, Kira Bevan. You know, I've got to have my two favourite Welsh girls. We'll have to move out now, sadly. Yeah. I had Ellie Kilden, but now she's injured. But she scored me quite a few points in the first game, so I was very happy about that.
Splendid.
But yeah, no, just watch it with everybody and anybody, basically.
I can't watch rugby in a pub. I can't do that. I find it difficult to watch rugby live because I don't know the game well enough to see who did what in the middle of that mall. So I need the commentators and the cameras to help.
Hence the reason for that. Hmm. You know, and I know that some rugby fans say, why are you saying that? We all know what a tight end does. But you don't all know what a tight end. And by the way, if we got to tweet to each other, I bet you do not know as much as you think you know about tight ends. Because actually...
We've got a tight end.
Is this or is this not true? Only the tight end or loosehead in a scrum knows actually who's dropped it. Actually knows.
Yeah.
And they both lie, won't they?
Yeah,
never tell
you
the truth.
Absolutely. So, wasn't me, referee? Yeah, wasn't me?
No.
No, come on, referee.
Who has got the most innocent look?
And it is dark arts, you know? There's a lot goes on in the scrum, in the front row, and it is very kind of like technical and knowing what you've got to do. And if you know your opposition, and this is the other thing, I mean, you'll appreciate this, Brian, you know, like, what they're not that good at or what they are, or what they always do if you play against them. Or maybe, if it's not an international, you might be on the same side. They might be a teammate as well. So having that dynamic, knowing people or not knowing them when you're scrimmaging down and then working together and working with a hooker and your loose head, that was just like, you have a strategy, you know, what you're going in to do. You're going to give them hell.
Our next podcast will be on the dark arts of the front row. Could you ever have seen yourself playing on the wing or in the centre, or do you want to be right in the thick of it?
No, I'm going to say that I've always been a big girl, so I was aptly placed, and I enjoyed it being in the thick of it. Lots of stamina. Yeah. I keep going, like a Duracell battery. Yeah. You just keep going.
But you're still playing now. Let's jump back to you glided over the House of Lords, House of Commons rugby match. Were there a few political points scored there? Are you allowed to nail somebody there?
No, the funny thing is that when we have, because they have like a Six Nations fixtures, and so myself and a few other women will go out and play against the Welsh Senedd. So that's always an interesting one. So, and it always coincides with the international game. So we'll go play. And when the women are on the pitch for a quarter of the game, we play touch rugby, and it's absolutely brilliant, and they're really inclusive, and really they want to be part of just playing, and they really love the women being there, so it's great, and I feel like I'm family.
Oh, you see, that's the joy.
Regardless of the politics, that's
regardless of the politics. Yeah, Tonya, you strike me as an unusual politician. I've met some oleaginous creatures dressed in chalk striped suits that you wouldn't trust with looking after your bicycle. But so, I think you bring a passion and a force and a belief to your rugby playing and to your politics. That's how it strikes me. I feel the force field of your personality here, and I'd vote for you.
Oh. Thank you, Jim. No, I think it really is. Politics is something that, I've got the skills from teaching and from being a rugby player. And it's just pulling them all together and applying them to real life. And that's what you do. Get out there and do what you can.
Get out there, do what you can. Join in, turn up, join in, be part of the game.
You do. You have to
Absolutely.
Be.
Absolutely.
Hey, Jim, just wanted to ask you a question.
Okay.
Who's your favourite rugby player, female rugby player?
My favourite female rugby player, I think I would probably pick, at the moment, there's a few to choose. I think Maud Muir, an England prop, who... She looks like butter wouldn't melt in her mouth. I've said this before.
Brilliant.
But she, when she's got a will and a power and a force to her, that I think, well,
the
I think
determination.
I think I'd get out of the way there. But I'm a big fan of Claudia McDonald. A lot of the team. I think this is a brilliant team. They haven't been tested in this World Cup yet, and we hope that when the big tests come, that they can live up to it and adapt to the game. But I think and the other one, of course, and this will please you because she's a Turk, Meg Jones. I mean Meg Jones,
brilliant.
In the centre, I think it is,
give her back.
I think she's a standout player for England. I think she's kind of the dynamo in the England team.
Brilliant. What about you, Brian?
Well, I was going to say Meg Jones as well, but I hesitated because I knew it would rankle with you. And I suppose you could say England's front rows, the two threes, are very good. Hannah Botterman is another example of a girl who is able to take a very significant role in the whole team, not because she happens to be the quickest, the most athletic, but she is very strong, she's very brave, her hands are actually very good as well.
Yeah.
There's a place for that, and I have a lot of sympathy for that, because actually, when you know the amount of, when you know what it takes out of you to scrummage and to hit rucks and mauls and then do those other bits, you then realise that these are not athletes as you would see on an athletics track, but they have a different form of athleticism, which is being rewarded within a team game and is as valuable as Ellie Kildun, as any winger, as any centre, who actually gets the glory for scoring the points.
Yeah, well, you've got to get the ball out, haven't you?
Exactly, you've got to get the ball first.
There's a few crossovers, aren't there? There's the Scottish winger who was a gymnast, I think, or was she a dancer? A
ballerina,
Ballerina, yeah. And
have you ever watched ballerinas train?
Oof. Oh, my...
They are... I watch the English... When the London Festival changed to the English National. Mm. We were playing France, and I've got a picture in a tutu, actually, with two of them, actually.
Oh, God, and, this is another one.
And, is that on social media?
Me and Gail Chilcott. It goes along with my Miss Hong Kong picture, which I won in 2001, when I was voted Miss Hong Kong at the Sevens. You're remarkable, actually. But everyone else left, because we're playing France on the Saturday, and I like ballet anyway, so I thought I'd stay, and I watched them for 2.5 hours, and I I was astonished at how hard they worked.
Yeah. Oh,
a lot of them with injuries, you know, slight injuries. And when everyone, you know, it's always made me laugh when people say, "Oh, but tell you what, you try doing half an hour of that. I bet you can't do. I bet you can't do 10 minutes of it."
Yeah. I mean, and blood pouring to their point shoes.
Oh, exactly.
I mean, I started off being a ballerina.
So did I, Tanya. Yes.
My mother's so proud of me and my little blue tutu.
My goodness. Yeah.
That's the three of us, then.
I know.
So, Brian, we've got an image firmly planted in our heads of you in a tutu.
Yep.
So while we've sort of gone off-piste a little bit, there's a rumour going around, and it's on Wikipedia, that you're also a qualified manicurist.
I am a genuinely qualified OPI. I do have to say OPI because it's a brand, but OPI nail technician. Just round the corner from where we're recording, which wife was it? Because I've had a few. My second wife and I had a nail bar.
Yeah.
It was basically this. We wanted to set one up. We were 10 years too early, actually. And I thought, well, you know, and I did the nails. And then, you know, my then wife ran it. But I thought, I'll get qualified because actually, you know, and I went for the exam and... in Luton, and they said, "Yeah, have you dropping someone off?" I said, no, I've come to do the exam." I said, "Well, we've never had a man do this exam before." I said, "Well, you have." I said, "You're not sexist, are you?" He said, "No, we're just surprised." And so I did. I am qualified. Yeah.
Was this putting on acrylic nails or?
You have to do two. You have your theory paper, and they said.
Theory of nails.
No. Yeah. Well,
they offer it as a university course now, I think.
And they said this is a really hard, remarkably high theory remark. I said, well,
what is a cuticle?
I've got a degree. I mean, I'm
a clever bugger.
Yeah, and then you know, and I could never do them. And then I did two perfect sets, and you know, you do one set, and then you do one set of extensions and whatever. And I just managed. Some people like pressure. That's what I said to my then wife. Just some people can handle pressure and some people can't.
And presumably the business folded because many people walked in and saw the pit bull there with a nail file in his hand and wearing a tutu and thought, no, I'm out of here. Thank you very much.
Brilliant.
Do you do feet as well or is that pedicure?
Well, pedicure is actually, you do the same exam, same thing, both nails.
Yeah. Excellent.
Right, well, I'll be over because I need them sorting out.
Well, I think we've had a knockout discussion. Tanya, it's been fantastic to have you with us.
Thanks, Tim.
You know, I think it's brilliant, the example you set through your rugby playing and in your political career and the way you enthuse about turn up, take part, join in, get some resilience, you know, and keep it going. I think it's a wonderful lesson to us all of us. I've really enjoyed talking to you and meeting.
We're Carter and Moore, off script and onside, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.